Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Stephen C. Wuhr, Program Chair of the Now and Then Speaker Series and your moderator for tonight's program. In this year-long series, which was conceived by Dr. Carol Fleming, the Commonwealth Club will examine American life and culture since World War II from a variety of perspectives. We are inviting recognized leaders to share their knowledge and observations about the important changes during this period from their particular area of expertise. In addition, we would like speakers to extrapolate about the trajectory of their field. What can we expect in the next 10 years? With the baby boom generation fast approaching retirement, this seems an appropriate time to pause and consider what these changes have meant to the people who have lived through this period of history and to American culture more broadly. Tonight, the Commonwealth Club of California is delighted and honored to present our next Now and Then speaker, Dr. Richard Friedenthal, past chairman of the Department of Plastic Surgery at the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco. Dr. Roger Friedenthal, as I said, is the immediate past chairman of plastic surgery at the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco, where he served for 15 years and was recently termed out. He is also an associate clinical professor at the University of California Medical Center. He is a graduate of Stanford University, where he earned his Bachelor of Science with great distinction. He earned his medical degree from Yale University School of Medicine and completed his medical internship at Yale Medical Center. He served on the staff of Stanford University Medical Center and the University of California Medical Center in San Francisco. He is the immediate past chair of the Department of Plastic Surgery at the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco. He is a native San Franciscan and is married and has six sons. Please welcome Dr. Richard Friedenthal.
Thank you very much. I even got a little bit confused there. Thank you. Thank you for this. This is a wonderful opportunity that I got to look back on plastic surgery, how it developed, and where it fits in with what's happened in medicine in general. Plastic surgery has been around for a long time, although in a somewhat limited fashion. Celsus, who is a Roman contemporary of Jesus, wrote about a repair of lips. The Susruta talks about cleft lip repair from probably about the 6th century BC. We have here an example of a nose reconstruction by a physician called Tagliacozzi in the 16th century. Noses were amputated as punishments, and the key was to use tissue from the arm, which if it was lifted up and sewn onto a raw area where the nose used to be, would then attach, and then he could cut it free from the arm and leave this tissue attached to the nose. Now, this has actually been used contemporarily as an odd procedure where a gentleman had a reconstruction of his nose with a very excellent result. Now, this sort of surgery, although it was present spottily and reported in history, could not go very far because it suffered from the two drawbacks which surgery had in general, lack of anesthesia and infection. The procedures which they had were certainly heroic, and the patients who underwent them electively were perhaps even more heroic. So we had to wait until things improved to the point where surgery could move. So let's look back about two present lifetimes, about 150 years, to the time of the Civil War. Now, in Civil War, surgery was also pretty primitive. This was one of their last injuries at the time. They had the beginning of anesthesia. They had chloroform and they had ether. It was used only spottily. The use of anesthesia was actually debatable for about 40 or 50 years. But they did what they could do under these acute systems. Here's one example. Now, in the reconstruction of the blast injury with the chin, obviously they took what they had and they reassembled it into the best approximation they could make. But they were unable to move any tissue in there. Now, the principle that Tagliacozzi used was to move tissue into an area from elsewhere. So that, and here is another example of plastic surgery from the Civil War with repair of injury. But all of these were reconstruction, as beautiful as they were, with tissue that was available locally. Now, the entire field changed during the time of the First World War. That's when it took off. And this is Sir Harold Gillies, a New Zealander who served in Britain. He was awarded knighthood subsequently. And what they found during the First World War, since now they could actually do things, they understood asepsis. Lister had introduced the first aseptic procedure in 1865, the year the Lincoln was assassinated. So the combination of aseptic surgery and anesthesia opened up the field. Now, Dr. Gillies, although it was Mr. Gillies because he was British in training, recognized that the usual limitations of medical specialty, i.e. ear, nose, throat, dental, oral, surgical, orthopedic, whatever, didn't fit the massive injuries that they would see on the battlefield. And these were, so what he did was to establish a center where the total repair of areas of the body were undertaken. And this really was the birth of plastic surgery in reality and as a specialty. Another example, upper left, is a air raid injury. But they took these little round tubey-like pedicles like you saw from Tagliacozzi in the 16th century. It could transfer tissue from all sorts of little places to all sorts of other little places if you could just move a tube from one place to another. You could rob Peter to pay Paul and then move that tissue around to make a nice, hopefully, reconstruction. Now, that was the First World War. By the Second World War, Sir Archibald McIndoe was working and became very famous for his work on reconstruction and on burn patients. This is an example of Dr. McIndoe's work on, your right is the young gentleman before their injury, and on your left after 50 operations to reconstruct his face. They were, the airmen that he helped formed a group called the Guinea Pigs because they knew that he was developing this field in front of them, and they were truly forever grateful. And then running along in a roughly contemporaneous fashion, we have Joe, what's his last name, Mahesh? Yeah, Joe Murray. Why? Dr. Murray is a plastic surgeon at Massachusetts General Hospital who in December 23rd, 1954, did the first kidney transplant. In 1990, he received a Nobel Prize for this. He will be 90 years old this April Fool's Day. That was something plastic surgery developed that it kind of got away from us. Now, the field that involved the use of these little tube flaps or different kinds of jump flaps received a tremendous boost. Here we have Dr. Stephen Mathis. He was chairman of the Department of Plastic Surgery at the University of California Medical Center. Dr. Mathis sadly passed away last year. And Dr. Fouad Nahai, between them, they developed the system of what we call myocutaneous flaps. What they found was that in transferring tissue, the skin in an area received its blood supply vertically from the muscle underneath. And some of these muscles received their blood supply functionally from a single artery in the vein. So it was possible to pick up an entire muscle and all the tissue on it, or any part of the tissue on it, swing it around like a crane and drop it down on another part of the body. This was used for breast reconstruction and many other types of reconstruction. It was a seminal event that completely changed the field of plastic surgery. Now, contemporaneously with this, actually starting before this, in about the late 50s and early 60s, is a local fellow, Dr. Harry Bunke. Dr. Bunke is a plastic surgeon in private practice here in the San Francisco Bay Area. He lived in Hillsboro. And with his own money, he was working in his garage in Hillsboro, trying to sew little tiny blood vessels together. I was really the first resident who worked with Dr. Bunke. It was thrilling, but there wasn't much practical value for it. We could take little tiny blood vessels, in this case, say 1 millimeter in diameter, 1/25 of an inch, put a dozen stitches around it, and reestablish the blood flow. Now, prior to Harry, microvascular surgery meant surgery that was vessels that were, say, 4 millimeters in diameter. They figured anything this small would require some kind of elaborate micromanipulators. What Dr. Bunke demonstrated is that with magnification and your bare hands, you could sew to this level under complete control. Now, we didn't have a lot of use for this. He developed the technique using rabbit ears. It took him over 300 rabbit ears to get the technique down straight. His son, Dr. Greg Bunke, who now runs the Bunke Clinic at California Pacific Medical Center, he was a little kid then, and when he saw a rabbit in school, he was astounded that it had 2 ears.
Oh.
Now, what he then moved on to demonstrate in a monkey that you could move the monkey's toe up to the monkey's hand to make a toe-to-thumb transplant. You can see on your left the tiny little size of the blood vessels that were being sewn. Now, there was not a lot of call for this kind of thing. I was in the race to sew back the first thumb, but it was really an exercise in fine control, but not a lot of practical value. But what happened was that this technique married with the microvascular flaps that Dr. Mathis and Dr. Nahai had popularized. And now you took the skin and the muscle not just down on a little artery and vein, but you cut that artery and vein, moved it anywhere you wanted to, and sewed it into an artery and vein somewhere in the other part of the body. They took this, and then they went crazy. On top of that, Dr. Bunke, who is an incredibly creative individual anyway, to be able to come up with this technique, really developed many, many, many creative ways to use this. Here was one of the first toe-to-thumb transplants. They were done here in San Francisco, first time ever. gentleman without a thumb who now has a functional thumb from the great toe. And here is a somewhat amazing example. Upper left is a hand which had all of the fingers largely amputated. Upper right, a thumb was transplanted. Lower left, two more toes were transplanted. And lower right, four toes were transplanted and a thumb, giving a perfectly functional extremity. Now, here is probably the most amazing thing about this whole thing. On your right is a toe-to-thumb transplant. On your left is a thumb, and in the middle is a great toe. So what happens here is that the toe remodels when it's in situ. Now, something's going on here, which is really, really important. We know the body replaces itself about every 7 years. It kind of knows where it goes and what gets replaced. If it gets out of whack, you get cancer. But if it stays in balance, everything gets replaced in the right way. So there's some kind of magical, not magical, perfectly normal, remodeling going on. Stay tuned for what's going to happen in this area at some time in the future. Now, here is an example of a piece of tissue with a little artery and vein coming off it. And here, for example, is a muscle, piece of muscle covered with a skin graft, which was transferred down to the lower leg to reconstruct a motorcycle-generated defect that would have previously caused a lower extremity amputation. The same kind of myocutaneous, we call them a myocutaneous free flap, the ability to take a flap of tissue, a piece of tissue, from somewhere on the artery and vein, sew it in somewhere else. Here is an example from Dr. Nahai, 1985, from a woman with a mastectomy. Where did you take it from? In this case, Dr. Nahai took a donor site from the lower part of the buttocks, wound up with a slightly smaller buttocks, and sewed it in to replace the breast. Also did, as we won't go into detail on, a reconstruction of the nipple and the areola on the breast as well. This whole area of breast reconstruction for mastectomy-type defects has moved from a simple attempt to ameliorate a problem into a potentially life-changing procedure. Here are two breast reconstructions from Dr. Rob Foster, University of California, San Francisco, using tissue from the stomach, from the abdomen, but without the use of a muscle, just taking the tissue. Now, that was the little saga briefly. I mean, we could talk for a long time about a lot of different things that could be replaced. But there's several other threads that are going on in plastic surgery at the same time. And here's another one of my heroes who gave us some slides, Dr. Bert Brent. All right, another local guy. Practices in Woodside, operates in Redwood City. This is a world-famous physician, just like Harry Bunke. Used to be a Green Beret. And he's an artist, and his attention is ears, not just prominent ears, which it would be enough by itself. But he took the entire palate that we use in reconstructive surgery, cartilage, muscle, connective tissue, skin, fat, nerve, and decided to take the problem of what they call microtia, children born without ears. The most famous ear reconstruction surgeon was Dr. Tanzer back east. Dr. Brandt went out to see Dr. Tanzer, but he got there after Dr. Tanzer finished his last operation and retired. Dr. Brandt's wife, who has suggested that he apply his artistic talents to ears, and he proceeded to do so, making the best ears in the world and turning the whole reconstructive ear surgery on its ear, okay? What he did was to use rib cartilage. Your ribs are bones in back and cartilage in front. It then needs to be covered with tissue and it needs to be freed up. But by using his artistic talents, he was able to demonstrate how you could carve your cartilage, cover it with tissue, and come up with a beautiful ear that would grow with the patient. Another example of this microtia, reconstruction. And as a consequence of this, ear reconstruction has changed throughout the world. Here's a rather more mature gentleman with a traumatic injury where his ear got rubbed off. Dr. Brandt carved this ear cartilage to replace it. And here is his reconstruction also. Good enough to wear glasses on. And he doesn't have his ear, his hair being worn long. So this is a wonderful episode in reconstruction. Now, another area that has been going on for a period of time has been cleft lip reconstruction. We have cleft lip, cleft palate, one-sided, two-sided. We'll just kind of brush at this. This is an example of a cleft lip defect. It happens to be what we call an incomplete cleft lip, which is there's still a little bridge of tissue going across the top. But you see how the lip is completely disconnected. It's come apart. And efforts were made to sew this together in antiquity, but it never looked anything like normal. The repair of this is somewhat complex. The key really came from Dr. Ralph Millard, although there were other techniques that were used.
Following his experiences in the Korean War, Ralph Millard revolutionized unilateral lip repair by placing the relaxing incision to rotate the Cupid's bow down at the top of the lip under the base of the columella. His C-flap was elevated. This extraprolabial skin was then used to insert into the defect to elongate the columella. A lateral lip flap was then advanced across to fill the defect, and the lip was closed.
Here is an example of a complete cleft lip. There is no bridge of tissue going across it. It goes straight up into the nostril. The nose itself is flattened on the side of the cleft and pulled apart. The bone is separated underneath. This is courtesy of Dr. William Hoffman, University of California. Dr. Hoffman is a specialist in pediatric plastic surgery. And we have a follow-up here on that patient, and then a later follow-up. Now, sometimes the reconstructions which have been done lack something. Here is clearly a teenager with a notched lip, a flat and widened nose with asymmetry, and a reconstruction revision afterwards. Seen from the side, you can see the correction of the retruded upper lip and the nose and a much more attractive, normal profile and appearance. There are also areas of what we call craniofacial surgery. This is a somewhat straightforward example of some very odd things indeed. Apert syndrome, in which there are recessions of the central part of the face, which get repaired here on a side view, is what that. So there are areas there that plastic surgery gets involved in which can be somewhat major indeed, or as fine-tuned as making cleft lip patients look normal. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the area that probably most people are familiar with here in plastic surgery, which is cosmetic surgery. We wind up skipping over all sorts of areas. And we'll take a look, at this. Sir Archibald McIndoe, who was the surgeon who did all of this incredible, heroic work on the burned aviators in World War II, also did cosmetic surgery. The classical nose that was created at that time, which was probably the late 50s, was a somewhat Grecian profile. Kay Kendall, a beautiful comedic actress of the time, who went to Dr. McIndoe for rhinoplasty. And Dr. McIndoe was shocked when the swelling went down and he found that he'd really given her a somewhat retrousse nose with a little lifted tip. And he felt awful, but she loved it. And so did most other people, too, and it became kind of like the style for about 30 years until about the 1980s. Now, there's nothing wrong with that particular kind of nose. As a matter of fact, it's really quite lovely. But there are other things that can be done in rhinoplasty. Maybe not quite so retrousse. Nose which is wide, which is narrower, and which has a bump, which is straight. So we have a lot of choices in how we want to do these nasal shapes now. But what we found after Dr. Jack Sheen wrote a seminal book about rhinoplasty, Dr. Sheen turned rhinoplasty on its head. Rhinoplasty before then was always making something large smaller. And if part of the nose was small, you had to make the rest of it really small to kind of match. Well, what Dr. Sheen pointed out was you don't have to just make things small. You can make them larger, and they'll look good. On your left is a gentleman who had an attempt to make his nose small. He said it was still large. You could see the round tip. He wanted it made smaller. I pointed out, given the size of his nostrils, there's no way that you could do that. Had to talk him into using some of his tissue to graft the upper part of his nose, to give him a stronger nasal bridge to bring the nose into balance. Also, some grafting was used to put some definition into the tip. So now we got into a type of rhinoplasty in which we're not only just taking away, we can be taking away and we can be adding. In this young man, the nose is projecting far enough to pull his upper lip forward. When the nose is recessed, as you can see later, the angle that the upper part of the upper lip makes has been changed. But we also took the tip of the nose, which was rounded, and added a little graft on the inside to give it some definition. So rhinoplasty, courtesy of Dr. Sheen, and now with other physicians who, like Gutter and Danielle and others who've advanced the technique, have brought us into some very rewarding areas. Now here, for example, is a nose which is what we call deviated. It's twisted is what it was. And we can straighten it, and here is the same gentleman. These are really life-changing procedures. This goes with the craniofacial. It's an advancement of the upper teeth. by advancing the bone. I'm sorry, it's out of line. Now, eyelid surgery. We're on our cosmetic run-through here now. Upper eyelids, over time, tend to droop a little bit, usually from the outer corners towards the inner. If the tissue is reduced, the eyes shine. This particular woman looks beautiful afterwards. They always look better. Beauty is, sometimes you get beautiful and sometimes you get cute. A friend of mine said you can go a long way on cute. You will note also that the brows are not elevated. There's nothing intrinsically beautiful about elevated brows. Brows can be higher, brows can be lower. It's an aesthetic judgment as to where it looks good. Now, here's an example of lower lid surgery, lower lid bags, and below without the bags. Big eyelid surgery is charming. It's fine, small, delicate surgery, but it's where everybody looks. So you get dramatic changes, really, for minimal procedures. Now, sometimes what happens with lower eyelids in particular is that they lose their support and they sag. And this gentleman has sagging lower lids, but they can be reattached and supported. And this is in a man. And here's the same thing in a woman who's in her mid-70s. Over a period of time, the eyes become shorter from side to side and flatter. By reattaching a little bit higher, we get a nice upward slope and a more almond-shaped eye. It's the first, this is called acanthopexy. It's the first thing we've been able to do to really rejuvenate lower eyelids. Brow lifts. This is a woman who just had a brow lift. She came to me asking for her upper eyelids to be done. I had to point out that the brows were resting on her eyelashes, so that we raised the brows and her whole expression changed. Brows that are down and brows that have a crease in the center give an angry look, regardless of how you feel. If they're raised up into a more natural position, they give a softer look. This is not a facelift. She had no facial surgery, only a brow lift. Brows are very powerful for giving changes in facial expression. Here's a combination of a face and a brow lift. The face has moved into a smoother texture, and the expression, again, you can see it starts out somewhat maybe angry. It's a wonderful woman. And slight repositioning of the brows really gentles the expression. To my mind, the purpose of facial surgery is to make people more approachable. Here's another example of a face and a brow lift. In particular, you notice the absence of the jowls. And if you look on the up here where you can see the bone, and here there's fullness that has been raised up to below the bone to give a good forward three-dimensional look to the face. Here's the before and an after in a somewhat more... Now, I grant you, she has a lot of makeup on afterwards, but that's the way we came in. And here also, and on this, also you can see the drop-off above the bone, below the bone, before, and how the tissue is raised up to give a more natural fullness. Liposuction was introduced in 1982 by Dr. Gérard Eluse of France. I saw him on the world scene in Oahu. He was talking about the liposuction and the Swiss cheese effect. I couldn't believe what he was doing. I was in France shortly after. Here's an example of a young woman who was run over by an ice cream truck. We trimmed it down, did a little scar work. And this is reconstructive liposuction. This is facial liposuction. Actually, it's liposuction of the neck on a young woman. If the tissues in the neck still have enough elasticity, we can give a dramatic change with liposuction alone without having to do facelift or skin tightening. But the lion's share of liposuction clearly is the body. This is my largest liposuction procedure, which is 24 pounds of fat on a single procedure. It is amazing how tissue can shrink with a little bit of help from elastic garments. You can see, again, this was a single step of abdomen, thighs, back, flanks, whatever. Generally speaking, I don't recommend large volume liposuction. It's interesting it can be done. However, this also falls, I think, perhaps under the definition of large volume, but it shows, I think, that if we have a young patient who has localized fat, please notice the narrow waist and the narrowness of the knees, and enough motivation to work out afterwards and to follow the proper diet and exercise routine, that it is possible to get some pretty amazing results that show a good degree of smoothness, I believe. Now, the last kind of area of slides I want to show is tummy tucks. This is a tummy tuck that cleared up rolls, also some liposuction to get rid of fat in the back. There is a long incision that runs across the bottom, and the navel is replanted. Here's another example of a woman who had a tremendous amount of stretch marks. She had a vertical scar from previous surgery, a lot of and some fat on the side. Liposuction trimmed up the body, and a tummy tuck or abdominoplasty tightened the tissue. What happens is we take this, the tissue from above the navel, and move it all the way down here. We cut a little hole to bring the navel out like a boutonniere, and that's the way they look. She also had stretched out muscles, which can happen with pregnancy, and at the same time as the abdominoplasty, as a routine, plastic surgeons will repair these muscles and give a tighter figure. Now, what does the future hold? Hard to predict, very hard to predict. I think stem cells are really exciting. Stem cells have the capacity to take off just like transplants have, and you're going to see where these things are going. There's also a whole area of non-invasive techniques that, well, I don't know if all of them are not ready for prime time, but there's some interesting stuff on the works. Like, how about non-surgical liposuction? Focused ultrasound paddles guided by computers go over the surface of the body, melt the fat underneath, and the body disposes of it. It works, and it's in clinical trials in Israel as we speak. I think that the future will be interesting. I want to thank you very much.
So maybe you want to stay there since we just have one microphone at the table. Okay. You showed some pretty dramatic photos from the Civil War time on battlefield reconstruction. In Iraq today, is this happening on the battlefield?
Well, the battlefield injuries, the plastic, they're stabilized and then flown out, excuse me, out to Germany and back here to the United States. We're doing amazing reconstruction and amazing salvage on our soldiers who've been injured. We're actually you know, it's a mixed blessing. It's the same way that the statistics on urban violence show a decrease in killings, you know, but it reflects better medical care and better salvage. In the Civil War, mostly there were amputations. The dictum in that war was even things that could be saved in a civil situation had to be treated by amputation. At that time, they didn't even have ambulances until well into the Civil War. Injured would lie around for days on the battlefield. The Union had 110,000 soldiers died of battlefield injury. They had 250,000 soldiers die of infection and other types of diseases. But now we're saving, we've got 10 injured for every one who unfortunately sacrificed their lives. And plastic surgery is strong in the rehabilitation.
What does plastic mean?
All right. It has no plastic. It comes from the Greek root plastos, which means to shape or form. We were here well before plastics, but they're bigger.
So there was a woman in the news recently, the Octomom, the woman that had the 8 babies, and there was a story that she had had plastic surgery to look like Angelina Jolie. Do you have clients that come in and say, I want to look like Julia Roberts or George Clooney?
rarely. And then you have to decide whether, you know, what's the situation. There is a remote possibility that they're crazy. You know? The remote possibility. But probably what's happening is that they're trying to communicate what they want as best they know how to do. And what I've found in general is that's really what they're trying to do. I will tell you, I've shared with you one story about one of my patients. I just like thought of, okay, I was running about 40 minutes late in the office, and I walked into one of my examining rooms, and I saw a woman writhing seductively on the examination table. Probably been writhing for 40 minutes, you know. So I walk in, I say, hello, I'm Dr. Friedenthal, you know, can I help you? So she sits up and gives me some unintelligible story about a judge and a prostitute. And I say, well, how can I help you? She says, I'd like a facelift. And I said, I really did say this. I said, I wouldn't do a facelift on you. I wouldn't touch you with a 10-foot pole. And she says, why? I said, because you're crazy. And she looked at me and she said, well, I'll go to L.A. where they won't notice.
But that's really part of the process is screening out those patients that it's a psychological issue rather than a real physical need.
Yeah, clearly if it is a psychological issue on the level that plastic surgery will not only not help, but will be blamed for the failure. And it can be a number of reasons. It can be someone who's off balance. It could be a person whose spouse is straying and they think that plastic surgery will solve the problem. It can be a lot of different things. And it is our responsibility to responsibly determine if this is so. And if it is, to figure out how to let them down gently if possible, or at least not to be the one who does the damage.
A questioner would like to know what portion of the surgeries are Beverly Hills type cosmetic surgeries versus the reconstructive surgeries you've outlined today.
Well, of course, this depends on who and where and when and what and at what point in your practice. By my particular time, I'm pretty much in cosmetic surgery. I have a fine young associate, Dr. Ed Miranda, who I worked with all through his training during his residency at University of California Medical Center. And Dr. Miranda, while he does cosmetic surgery, does a tremendous volume of excellent reconstructive surgery using some of the latest techniques. So I think that the answer is that the practices tend to evolve. They are clearly usually reconstructive at the beginning, moving up towards blended and having more cosmetic at the end, although some people come out of the chute.
And is it common for doctors to volunteer or their services either overseas or locally where people can't afford the types of services that you provide?
Well, we certainly have the volunteer services set up abroad. The little video clip you saw was from the Smile Foundation that sponsors cleft lip and palate surgery, and if you see their appeals, I urge you to consider a generous donation. The money goes directly there with very little overhead. Their missions to Guatemala, Saipan, all sorts of different parts of the world. Yes.
The photos you showed of people that had had eyelid surgery were very dramatic. What is the cost of a procedure like that?
Well, it kind of varies, you know, but probably you'd be talking, I don't know, eyelids, maybe single uppers or lowers, anywhere, including an operating room, anywhere from $3,500 to $5,000. Double upper and lower eyelids, probably maybe 7 to 10. It's hard to tell. You can find people, well, you know, you can get dinner at Masa's and you can get dinner at some really excellent restaurants as well. So the prices vary.
That's right. Some of the local papers run advertisements for Clinica Estetica in Tijuana.
Yes, there was a doctor, Mike Miguel Angelo, Michelangelo.
It seems, a questioner says, it seems that some doctors will do as much cosmetic surgery as a patient wants. Do you think this is irresponsible, and at what point can the doctor be held liable?
Well, certainly the television programs more recently have popularized getting many procedures done at once. There's kind of a balance. I mean, you can, it's not unusual to do a facelift, upper and lower eyelids, and a brow lift, maybe with a rhinoplasty. But I wouldn't add to that a breast lift, a liposuction, and a tummy tuck, you know. There's, how much can be done is a function of, well, it's a lot of different things. Certainly it's possible to do too much surgery on somebody. This wouldn't be safe, and I don't think one should do that. It's not necessary to do it in little tiny bits. You figure out what you can do. On a patient who's lost maybe 150 pounds, they may need tightening all over their body. It's hard to, even though you may be talking about legs, stomach, breast, face, arms, you can't do endless numbers of operations, so you figure out how you can combine them together. I don't think that, from the standpoint of liability, I think it's a function of doing things responsibly. And responsibly is clearly, there are a lot of different variables. Certainly there's the physician's experience. Certainly there's the knowledge of what in general is appropriate. And certainly there's the patient himself or herself. You don't have the same parameters in someone who's 35 and someone who's 85. It just needs to be, all these things need to be carefully considered. And I'll put in a plug for my organization, American Society of Plastic Surgeons, really high standards, board examinations, stringent ethical standards. But they're good surgeons who do plastic surgery in different areas and in different parts of the world. Simply important to get a good, responsible surgeon.
What are the most common procedures that women have done?
Well, up until this year, liposuction was the leader. This year, breast implants took over. Well, procedures generally fall into the body and the face group. In the body group, liposuction, tummy tucks, then different breast surgery, make them larger or you reduce them pretty much. These are under the cosmetic areas. And then facial surgery, which is generally speaking nose, eyes, brows, face, ears, maybe hair.
Is it the same for men?
Men, well, they're a little more conservative, although they're getting a little more enthusiastic. Hair transplants are almost entirely in men, although some women have male pattern hair loss. Eyelids and liposuction in men are really popular.
I have a very good friend, a woman, who at one time was about 440 pounds, and she had surgery and had most of her stomach removed, and then she had 14 surgeries after that. Could you talk a little bit about what those surgeries would have entailed?
I don't know about the 14. It's pretty amazing. I don't know what the story was in that. I would say that, again, usually it's about three surgeries. Well, I mean, there are only so many areas that you're going to be repairing, and they vary. I didn't bring any pictures of this particular kind of problem, but some people, it depends where the weight is concentrated. For some people, the center trunk is the major area, and a central, it's like a tummy tuck that goes all the way around. Take a piece out and pull it together. Some people, it's their thighs, particularly. Usually the face is spared for some reason. I mean, not always, but very, very often. Arms, very often arms, and breasts. So there are only those many areas. How you want to split them up is a function of person and their desires, their concepts of how they want to look. I've done sometimes many individual surgeries, and someone who's trying to really look as good as they can over a period of time, and that's perfectly okay as long as there's something to work on. You need something to work on. If you work on something when there isn't something to work on, you'll simply make it look bad.
Could you just talk a little bit more about the difference between a tummy tuck and abdominal liposuction?
Sure. This exists on an entire spectrum. It depends on how much skin looseness there is, or maybe muscle looseness. Let's just talk about, suppose that the abdomen is bigger than you want, but the skin is tight, or at least it's not loose. Then liposuction is perfect. The problem is one of fat. You get rid of the fat, and it looks good. Now, this is not beer belly fat. There's a type of fat deposition that men have. It's called a beer belly, in which if you pinch the fat on the outside, you don't get very much, maybe an inch. And it's all around the intestine. That clearly is not suitable for liposuction. But if it's the kind of fat that you can grab, love handle type fat, then liposuction is the proper approach. Now, after pregnancy, let's say, when there's been stretching of tissue, now you have too much skin and maybe some stretched out muscle. Under those circumstances, then you need an abdominoplasty or a tummy tuck, often with some liposuction to tune it up. But the primary procedures, one of tissue tightening and the fat removal is secondary, versus the liposuction where the fat removal is the raison d'etre and the skin shrinkage takes care of the rest.
What do you think of neck lifts?
What do I think of them? Well, they're lovely if the necks are loose. Usually, isolated neck lifts are done occasionally, not very often. Usually, neck looseness is a reflection of general cheek and facial looseness, which has finally fallen down, as it will, down to the bottom. The best appearance is raising everything up to where it needs to go rather than just trimming it off at the bottom. So neck lifts are very valuable, but almost invariably as a portion of a cheek and neck lift. Not always, but usually.
Can you speak to the safety of these outpatient procedures and also what the recovery is like?
Safety, again, it depends on the patient. There are different classes. If anesthesia risk is class 1, 2, 3, 4. If you have a class 1 anesthetic risk, fine. Outpatient is great. Outpatient liposuction, for instance, but only up to a certain amount. They found clearly that if a lot of fat is removed, then there can be big shifts of fluid within the body afterward. Not something that you want to happen at home where a patient is not observed. So there's a level of procedures which can be done as an outpatient. And then beyond that, I think there's a level of procedures in which there needs to be some observation to make sure that problems don't develop. Problems can develop. Problems will develop. We don't expect them. We're ready for them. It's just like driving. You don't expect a problem, but you're ready for it. And we do the surgery the same way. In cosmetic surgery, we have a particular responsibility to use an excess of caution and to proceed only when we feel that the chances of a good success are overwhelming. I mean, there's not zero risk in anything, so we can't talk about zero risk. But it's not heart surgery. In heart surgery, if 10% of the patients don't survive the procedure, 90% did and none would if they hadn't had the procedure. So that's a different kind of calculation. In this kind of aesthetic surgery, is there any proportion of patients that you could ruin in an effort to make somebody better? No, the answer is as close to zero. So you're not trying to push the edge in that way. You're trying to do what you can consistent with as much safety as possible. I always look at a risk-benefit ratio when I'm considering surgery. If there's, you know, the always present risk, but there's a lot of benefit, that looks like this might be something that you could consider doing. If there's a lot of risk and the chance of benefit is very small, you shouldn't do this at all. Now, these are two poles, and obviously there's a lot of gray stuff in the middle. They're affected by this and that.
So death is exceedingly rare?
I hope so. Okay. Well, I mean, it's universal, but under the...
This questioner wants you to go out on a limb. He or she works for a surgeon and is embarrassed to go to the surgeon that they work for and wants to know if you would recommend anyone in the San Francisco area.
No. Well, no, not that I can't recommend somebody in the San Francisco area. If, for whatever reason, the questioner feels that particular way, all right. If you'd like some straight talk, call my office and talk to my wife, Marquise, 415-752-2066. She'll give you the honest stuff. No question about it, you know.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program we have time for only just one more question. And I was intrigued by your discussion about the future. Could you talk a little bit more about stem cells and what the future might hold?
Well, the exciting thing about stem cells, clearly, seems to be their ability to turn into different tissues, to turn into heart muscle, to turn into bone, to turn into things. Now, bone is less, I mean, you can get bone, plenty of bone, but you can't get plenty of heart. Certainly the ability to turn into nerves. It's extremely exciting. The question, of course, is where do you get them and how do you process them? And what is their antigenic profile going to be? One of the best ways to get stem cells clearly would be from a person's own tissues. The concept that you still have stem cells, I mean, in liposuction, there are apparently lots of stem cells. There are enough stem cells in the fat that comes from liposuction that that fat, when reinjected, has regenerative qualities, even to tissue which has been atrophied from irradiation. This is the body is clearly holding the regenerative potential of stem cells under incredible control, so that only rarely does a cancer appear as things get out of control. So we're thinking conceivably about the possibility of using what they call adipose-derived stem cells that you can get from an individual by concentrating a liposuction that you do on them, and then having these cells potentially regenerate into whatever you need. I mean, there's a time factor involved. You don't make a heart right away. But there's some, as you saw in that toe-to-thumb remodeling, the body and the cells have a modeling capacity that I know we're going to learn how to use.
How many years out is that?
Oh, who knows? We know so little. We know so little. We don't know why anything happens. I mean, if I hold up something and drop it, you say, why? Is it because of gravity? I don't know what gravity is. I can calculate it, I can describe it, and someone gave a name to it. But giving a name to something doesn't mean that you understand it. In medicine, someone says, why did I get whatever? I don't know why you got whatever. You know, I may have an idea how to treat it, but I don't know why you got it. I don't know why a cell develops into a human being. I don't know how things differentiate. I don't know why they go wrong. You know, I don't understand what life is. We are able to manipulate parts of this, like very, very clever people. But I don't know what'll happen, and I don't know when. I'm excited.
Thanks to our speaker, Dr. Roger Friedenthal, for his participation in the Now and Then series. I would also like to thank our listening audience, both here and on radio, for your attention this evening. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating 105 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.